Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is my favorite investor of all time. His name is Jim Rogers. Jim, welcome back to the show, my friend.
George, I am delighted to be here. I'm very, very keen.
Now, I was speaking with Jesse Felder the other day. I don't know if you know who he is. And he's someone that's very famous in the macro world in the U.S. I know you're in Singapore. You haven't been in the loop for too long. But he is someone that admires what you've done to a great degree as well. And we were talking about Russia, of course. That's the topic of the day. And we were trying to think through what would Jim be doing right now, because we know that this is what you have done since the 1960s, as far as being a contrarian investor and going into places that no one wants to touch with a 10-foot pole. No one would even consider going into these places. And Jim, you have always seemed to go in and do well. And so what are you doing with Russia right now? What's your take on what's happening?
Well, George, yes, I would like to be investing in Russia right now. The whole place has totally collapsed, financially anyway, but it's impossible. The market's closed. The currency markets are closed. The brokers won't take orders. If you can find, and certainly not in Moscow, maybe you could find somebody in New York or London who would make a trade with you, but it's very, I have not found anybody. Not that I've looked that hard, because I know the situation, but it's one of those times and places that historically, if you invest when there's pure chaos and you have the staying power, you make money. I wish I could, but I cannot. You can't even buy government bonds.
Yeah, I'm assuming that you had Russia on a watch list prior to the invasion. I can't, you know, it was on the Thursday or whatever. And so what kept you, what prevented you from investing when like Lukoil and Sberbank and Gazprom, I'm sure a lot of businesses that you follow very closely, when they were really taking a haircut, they're getting super cheap, but obviously not as cheap as they are now with everything frozen. So what made you, why were you patient? What made you disciplined there?
Well, I didn't buy any of those shares because I just didn't think it was enough panic yet. It turned out I was right. But for once, it's a good thing I didn't work. I didn't do something. And now I cannot do something. Some of those stocks are just unbelievably cheap. Unless Russia is going to disappear, which is unlikely, some of these things would be great buys if we could buy them. But I don't even think the Russians can buy these stocks now. I know they cannot in Moscow.
Yeah. So have you seen something like this happen before? What time in your investing career have you seen something similar to this? And what was it?
Well, I would just go back and say, and by the way, George, you don't always, it's not always good to invest. I said before, if you have the staying power and you can do it, you will make a lot of money. But if you'd invested in Cuba in 1960, you'd still be waiting. So don't think it's always that easy. We've had wars and problems before. I remember when Japan had a tsunami back in 2011.
Yeah.
I was already buying Japan, and then the tsunami hit, and I bought a lot more to my delight and shock. And, you know, the market quadrupled in the next few years. It's not quite the same as the war that we're seeing now. I cannot remember, although it's just because I'm not thinking about it, war situations like this, with which it presented markets and presented opportunities in a big market. Iraq was a war, but there was basically no market. So you have to find a place that has a market, a viable market, and a disaster. The Asians, who've been around longer than we have a word that means, what it means is opportunity and disaster are the same thing.
Right.
It's interesting. The Chinese character, the Korean character, and the Japanese character are all exactly the same. They're pronounced differently, obviously, but they all mean opportunity and disaster are together.
So how are you personally playing it from here moving forward? Like, what would be the catalyst? I know that, you know, we've talked about this several times, and this is the conclusion that Jesse and I actually came to, and we were thinking through what would Jim Rogers do right now. We said he'd probably be hyper-focused on Russia, but he probably wouldn't have pulled the trigger. He'd probably be waiting for a catalyst for some sort of change to give you the green light. So what are you intently focused on when there is that catalyst?
I don't think it's possible to invest in many things, if any things, in the Russian financial markets right now. Certainly not outside of Russia, not inside Russia either, or if it's possible, maybe outside Russia. The catalyst would be that it opens. And since I would be a little cautious, the catalyst would be, well, it opens and then I would watch to see what happens. If it opens and everything totally collapses, that would be a signal that I should be buying.
And then what if it does the opposite? What if it opens and it just skyrockets?
Well, I'd say, well, I had a good idea, but I was a fool. I didn't do anything. but it would depend, you know, when they open and they skyrocket, usually for a few minutes, if you're there and alert, you can do something. Obviously, if you're late, you're late and you miss it. No, I don't, nothing you can do. I don't want to buy something when it's skyrocketing unless I'm in at the beginning of the skyrocket.
Yeah. Yeah. I went back and reviewed some of the, you know, the stuff, some of the trades that you made or the investments, I should say, back in the 1980s that I thought was kind of applicable to this from the standpoint of you actually didn't pull the trigger because you thought they may just close the market. They thought they may take your shares. But one that came to mind was, I believe, Japan in 1990 when they collapsed, or maybe it was in the late 80s, you're thinking about shorting Japan, but you're hesitant because you thought they may change the rules. I think that was your specific line. And you use the example of the Kuwait stock market in 1981 or 1982, when they were allowing people to buy shares with post-dated stocks or post-dated checks, excuse me. And you said that you wanted to short that so bad, but you didn't because you knew that the government would do something to where you couldn't get your money back. And so that kind of reminded me of what we're seeing play out in Russia today.
Well, they always, not always, but the governments frequently change the rules on you. And the Kuwait example was a very good example that they especially would change the rules if they wanted to, but it's a risk anywhere. For instance, now Russia's changed the rules. They close the market. Yeah. They make it impossible to buy and sell anything. You can't even buy government bonds. Foreigners cannot buy government bonds, and Russians can't either, because everything is closed. They do change the rules. I've seen many times they change the rules. You remember the Hunt brothers back in, maybe you remember when they were shorting, they were buying silver. And then the exchange changed the rules to protect the members. You know, exchanges aren't supposed to protect the customers, but in Chicago, they protected the members. And the Hunts went bankrupt because they changed the rules on them. You always have to be careful of that, especially if it's a country, because countries, not always, but very frequently will change the rules. So one has to watch out.
How do you hedge that? Just through position size, or is there some other way?
I don't know anyway. You just have to know. I have enough experience or read enough to know that, okay, if they change the rules, what do I do? Right. And the Hunts, who didn't have much experience, there was nothing they could do because the exchange had more power than they did. Mm-hmm. And the exchange changed the rules to protect the members. The members were all shorting to the Hunts. The Hunts had a lot of money in those days and a lot of margin power. And I certainly did not know that they were going to change the rules in those days. But if they want, you always have to be aware. If you're investing in something that's moving a lot or a disaster, somebody will or could change the rules.
Right, right.
It's not fair. It should not happen. It's not the way the world's supposed to work. So call your congressman.
Yeah. So now you touched on a point there that I wanted to bring up. You're saying, you know, with your reading, and now, you know, we've got the media, and there is just so much propaganda in the West. I don't know if you're staying current with the Western media because you're in Singapore, but it's just, it just seems obnoxious at times. But I know that there's an equal amount of propaganda probably on the Russian side. So how, in your career of investing, how do you sift through the propaganda to try to find the truth as to what's actually happening?
It is an extremely insightful question, and I'm delighted you ask it. What I tell my daughters who I'm trying to teach how to live in the world, I tell them, try to read or listen to four or five sources from four or five different countries, because every country tells you the truth. They think they're telling you the truth. But the problem is, if you listen to five different countries, they cannot all be the truth. So only, and I do it myself, it's why I try to teach my children. You have to listen to the sources from everywhere, and then you still might not get it right. Then you have to put it in your poor brain and turn it around and figure out what's really happening, especially in war. I'm not the first person to know that, what was the saying? Truth is the first casualty of war. Yeah. You know, even the Greeks knew that thousands of years ago. American senator said that in the First World War. Truth is the first casualty of war. But at least if you know that, you got a leg up. Because then you will realize, okay, now we have to figure out what's really happening. And that requires listening to stories from everywhere. You listen to the Russian side, the Ukrainian side, the American side. They all tell you a different story.
I know you were following geopolitics quite a bit back in the 90s. I would assume when kind of the Soviet Union fell and the Berlin Wall came down. And I think that was about that was when NATO was formed, I believe, when the Soviet Union crumbled. So what was your impression of NATO back in the 90s or the late 90s? And did you ever think that they would play a part in what we're seeing today? Were you hesitant? Were you a little bit worried back then that that it might not go well, that Russia might push back?
A slight correction. No, NATO was formed after the Second World War, when the Berlin Wall fell.
Okay.
When the Berlin Wall fell, they started expanding to some of the Central European countries. When the Berlin Wall fell, everybody was excited and delighted. I was looking for investments. I started making small investments in Central Europe and Russia, because I mean, Russia is a gigantic country with huge, huge, huge assets. I mean, it's been abysmally managed for a lot of its history, but there were and are opportunities whenever something falls apart. It's, as I say again, if you can invest in a disaster, you're probably going to make a lot of money if you have the staying power. It's not that easy. I repeat the Cuban example. If it was a disaster, we'd still be waiting. North Korea, you would still be waiting. So it's not that simple.
Yeah, but I think the key goes back to not only finding panic and buying panic, but also waiting to buy panic once there is a significant catalyst. That's really the key.
Absolutely. I went to Venezuela sometime during last year, but during the total collapse, went down, and it was a total collapse. But then America said, sanctions, you cannot invest in Venezuela. So even then, the Venezuelans didn't change the rules. They love for somebody to come and invest. But America said, no, you cannot invest there.
Yeah.
And we're citizens of the land of the free, George. We're not so free sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. But now it's, the United States is trying to get Venezuela to produce more oil to make up for the sanctions against Russia. It's just amazing how the politicians are so hypocritical.
these guys, exactly, hypocritical. I'm sure there's a worse word than that to describe these guys. You know, they've been shrieking about Venezuela for a long time, doing everything they can to punish them. And now they're saying, oh, hello, hello, Venezuela.
Russ.
Got any oil?
Yeah, exactly. So what's your update? The last time we talked, we're kind of looking around the world for opportunities. We talked about Colombia. I'm in Medellin right now, actually. We also talked about Turkey. And
you're in Medellin right now?
Yeah.
Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I'm envious.
Yeah.
I'm envious.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous place.
It is an unbelievable city. It is. And I'm sure the opportunities are even better now. Well, I'm extremely envious, George.
Well, the last time we spoke, you said your favorite two cities for investment, and this was probably about a year and a half ago or so, maybe a year ago, was Medellin and Vladivostok, if I'm saying that correctly. And so I'd love to just start there. I don't know if you've done any research or anything has come up on your radar as far as those two cities since we talked. Does anything interest you there?
Well, Vladivostok, of course, is closed because you cannot buy Russian anything right now. But yeah, I have a fabulous prospect company in Vladivostok. It's a shipping and port. They own the port, and Vladivostok is going to be a great, great city for many reasons. Putin wants to make it a great city, and he will, and he is. But doesn't matter. It's academic right now. I don't have any investments in Medellin. Well, I have one marijuana company in Cuba, Colombia. I should ask you. You must be finding investments in Colombia.
Well, I just focus in on real estate here. I've been investing in real estate here since 2015, and it was just amazing when COVID hit. They really went into a strict lockdown here. And I actually was able to get a humanitarian flight out because I didn't want any part of the lockdown. And I went and hung out in St. Bart's actually for a couple months with our good friend, Hugh Hendry. I don't know if you remember Hugh.
Yeah.
Because that was the only place that was really open. And I thought that my real estate investments here would take a significant hit. But oddly enough, the real estate here has done just what it's done in the United States. And that's basically gone straight up. So it's just, it's bizarre that we're living in this world that where asset prices should be deflating, but they're actually increasing significantly. So I don't know how that ends. I don't know if you've got any insight there.
Well, Medellin, you have the advantage that, you know, they went through a long war, civil war, call it what you will. And so prices weren't skyrocketing, going through the roof. Right now in Korea, it's a huge bubble, but that's because they started from a high place. And I would not think about buying property in Seoul right now. And so when it collapses, it's going to have a big collapse. But in Medellin, it started from nothing.
Yeah, right.
They had a horrible. I'm going to tell you a story. I don't know if we won't have much time, but I remember a general told me, I went once when I was meddling once, he said, you know, a woman would, a guy would call up and say to a lady, call the owner of a property and say, I want to buy your property. The guy said, what are you talking about? My property's not for sale. And the guy said, if you don't sell it to me, I'm going to buy it from your widow. And sure enough, guy got killed and they bought it from his widow. That was the sort of thing that was happening in Medellin back in the drug wars and worse stories. So Medellin wasn't starting from a high level. That's my only idea of why Medellin has continued to rise. When you open up a country from a war or a civil war, the opportunities are fantastic and always have been. They start from a low base. There's no capital, there's no added ambition, there's no energy, everybody's depressed, so it can go on forever. Look at Japan after the war. I mean, I can use many examples.
Yeah,
when things get so depressed, the bull market or the upturn can go on for a long time.
Yeah,
so you were genius.
You know, another thing that's fascinating, I just got back about a month ago. And I'd been gone since the beginning of 2020. And I was in the United States, in Arizona and Florida, just trying to find a bit of freedom. And it was amazing that when I was back in the United States, there were a few places where the businesses really, really took a hit because of the lockdowns. But, you know, the United States had all those PPP loans and stimulus checks and these artificial ways to prop up the economy through government deficit spending. So when things started to reopen, you didn't see a lot of the businesses change over. Right. There wasn't a lot of turnover with the businesses. A lot of them had actually stayed afloat. Or when I came back to Medellin about a month ago, I mean, I'm in Poblado. I'm sure you're familiar with the area in Provenza and Parqueiras. And this is when all the cafes and the restaurants and the hotels, and not all of them, but I would say 50% of them are new. The old owner went out of business. They didn't have enough in savings. And they went belly up because they couldn't get the stimulus checks and the PPP loans. And so new owners came in, remodeled the space, and now has a new restaurant there catering. And it's just this vibrancy, but it reminded me of Schumpeter's Creative Destruction. And you see it right in front of your own eyes playing out in real time in Colombia. And I think that makes the market and the economy far more dynamic. Where in the United States, you see that atrophy that you kind of saw in Japan because the government propping it up and not only allow businesses to fail. And what do you have any takes on that? I know that you've said so many times in the financial media that you got to let businesses fail. And that's one of the most important parts of capitalism, and let the people who make good decisions come in and take over the assets and then improve the economy and therefore improve society. But have you seen that in these emerging markets to a greater degree than in the West?
Well, of course, because usually in emerging markets, they don't have enough money to prop up failure, prop up disaster. It does happen, of course, everywhere. No, but in the US, we have the view that nobody should fail. Everybody should be saved and propped up. There should be no victims. Fortunately, there are still markets like Colombia where they don't have that attitude, partially because of their own history, because of the war. I mean, they couldn't prop people up. And Colombia, you know the story. I mean, we went through this long, long, long civil war and drug wars and everything else. I met a general at the ex-president's house in Medellin once, and he was telling me that, you know, I spent a lot of my career trying to kill these guys and put them in jail, and now I am one. He was a marijuana farmer. You know, it's legal now. It's legal now in Colombia. And so, you know, everybody changed and changed with the world and are now prospering. No, I'm very envious of you and very, very proud of you. Very proud to be speaking to you in Medellin.
So they've got an election coming up. It's in a few months, I believe. And a lot of the people here are worried because the guy that's in the lead right now was good buddies with Chavez. And he kind of has that same Chavez, like Maduro type of mindset. So as an investor, is that something that would concern you? Or is that something that's kind of just noise?
Well, again, I am not there, and I'm not up to date. I must, to my chagrin, but you have to worry about that. I mean, if it is going to be Castro taking over Colombia, it's not going to be fun. But usually, guys like this scare people. But then, when they get into power, they realize that they have to make things better, both for themselves and for the country. I just don't know. I don't know. I do know that Colombia has astonishing possibilities. They've got assets. They've got everything. And the city, Medellin is such a beautiful, gorgeous city and so big. You know, many possibilities. But George, I just don't know because I'm not up to date.
Yeah. I remember going back to 1982, I believe, you bought shares in Germany. And they had just been kind of bottomed out doing nothing for, I think, like 15, 16, 17 years. And the catalyst, but you said the economy was booming, but the stock market just didn't get any love. Just no one was paying any attention to it. And they had I think it was the Democratic Christians or something. I think that was maybe the
Christian Democrats. Christian Democrats.
Yeah. And they had a guy that was claiming that he was going to be pro-business and he was going to be very kind to foreign direct investment and whatnot. And you told Jack Schwager that you were listening to him and you believed him. And another thing, I remember you saying that when Paul Volcker was saying that he wanted to break the back of inflation, that you believed him. So what makes you believe a politician and what makes you not believe a politician?
Well, that's a good question. I guess we have to watch him on Rebel Capital and to get to
when
get
I the, interview him.
Yes, get the real story. With the case of Volcker, it was partly because at the time Jimmy Carter said to Volcker, "You do whatever you have to," and I don't know how I knew that. I mean, I guess maybe everybody must have known it, but Volcker knew what had to be done, and that's why they picked Volcker. But Carter and Volcker went to Carter and said, "Okay, this is not going to be fun. It's going to hurt a lot of people." And Carter says, "I don't care what it takes. You do what you have to do." Now, I don't know if Carter knew what he was talking about because it cost him the election when interest rates went skyrocketing. But that's one of the things that convinced me, because Volcker knew what to do and Carter apparently had said, "Do it. I will take the pain." So that's one of the things, that one reason I thought I knew what I was doing. I don't know. You read a lot of sources and put it all in your brain and hope you get it right.
Yeah. And same thing with the German guy, just reading a lot of sources.
German, especially. And the beauty of Germany in those days, I mean, it's probably hard to understand, but that's 40 years ago. But the German stock market was essentially unknown, undeveloped. The right. Germans, partly because of the war, you know, still basically for most Germans, savings accounts were where they put their money.
Yeah, right.
The stock market was not very well known, not developed, not anything, and therefore it was very, very cheap. I remember speaking to a smart friend of mine in New York, and somehow or another we were talking about GE, and I said, "Well, Siemens is half the price, and you know, as gigantic, as successful, as powerful, etc." And he looked at me like I was a madman. Hmm. How can you talk about Siemens compared to GE? Right. But that was also the mentality of American investors back in those days. Most people, even in 1982, still only invested in stocks in New York, maybe over the counter, if not on the New York or the American. But I mean, those days are gone. Now we have everybody, they're all kind of MBAs on airplanes right now, flying around the world looking for new countries. But in those days, even the German stock market was unknown and ignored and ridiculed.
Yeah. What was the liquidity like back then? And did that ever concern you?
Well, of course it does. But Siemens was a gigantic company. And when you buy something like Siemens, at least I thought, the worst that happens is I'm stuck with it. But I was never that big time that I got stuck with Siemens because it was not liquid enough. Not a rich guy like you, George, wouldn't have to worry about that. But I was never worried about getting stuck with too much Siemens.
Yeah. Do you think that there's, going back to Russia today, do you think there's some investments possibly on the fringe that could be indirectly cheap as a result of what's happening in Russia? The first thing that comes to mind, maybe European stocks, maybe they could be taking a big hit because of what we're seeing there. Could that be a potential opportunity?
Well, of course, if you can, but back to the Russia, I mean, I'm a director of a Russian company. It's one of the largest fertilizer companies in the world. The stock has been, there is no, you cannot buy and sell the stock, even the bonds. You cannot buy and sell the bonds. We had a meeting, board meeting, and I said, "Listen, let's buy the bonds because they're probably being smashed." Mm. Can't buy them because the markets have just disappeared. So yes, I know there are great, I know this company. I would love to buy more shares of this company. But it, the markets are closed, so it cannot, it will not work. But there must be other opportunities as I think about it. And I haven't looked at some of the Scandinavian companies only because I'm lazy, but the Scandinavian companies may be opportunities now. Some of those places like Lithuania, Estonia, small markets, but they, I don't know. Sorry, George, I've been lazy. I got to watch Rebel Capital.
Oh, no, it's fine.
You do the work and let me know.
No, Jim, I really enjoy hearing you think out loud.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist Show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today.
Another thing that's been on my radar that might be cheap, and I don't know if you've been too lazy to look at it, but it would be the U.S. cannabis stocks, talking about marijuana. Have you looked into those lately? I know they've really taken a hit.
I didn't know. My marijuana play is this Columbia company that it's interesting. Well, you probably know this by now. I did not, but marijuana likes certain temperature, certain amount of daylight every day, stability, consistency. And so the equator is perfect for marijuana because the daylight is the same all the time. The temperature is the same. That's why Columbia became a great drug center. It wasn't because all these evil guys went there and said, let's do drugs. No, they had a competitive advantage. They had marijuana had an economic advantage. And that's still the case with Columbia in Colorado. Yeah, you can do it, but it costs you a lot of money to build the special buildings, electricity, temperature, everything. Labor. Yeah, everything. So you don't have the competitive advantage in Colorado that they still have in Columbia and places like that. I have not, again, because I'm lazy, I haven't looked at the Canadian or the U.S. marijuana stocks, but you give me an idea, so I'll have to start doing some research.
Yeah. Now, another thing that I'm struggling with is in the United States, let's say your expenses are denominated in dollars and you're living in the United States, you've got CPI running at 7.5%. And we all know that realistically, that's probably 12, 15%, something like that. So if you're holding cash on the sidelines, you're losing a lot of purchasing power. But at the same time, you've got the yield curve that's flattening. You've got the Fed potentially raising interest rates, maybe even into a recession. You have what's going on in Russia that could bring down U.S. equities. There's a lot of reasons to hold a decent sized cash position for some dry powder. How do you usually kind of navigate that as far as your cash position? Do you have any set rules or just kind of play it by feel?
No, I have to play it by every situation is different. Usually every situation is different. Yes, maybe you're making 1% on your money. But George, you know as well as I do, it's better to make 1% than to lose 15% on your money. So being forced into cash, if I could use that term, can be good for you. at times, if you know or if you think that the opportunities are developing and are coming. But even then, you have to be sure it's the right cash. At the moment, US dollars for me is the right cash or are the right cash. But I remember in 2007, a lot of people who said, oh, this is all going to end. I got to get out of the market. So I got to put my money in cash. And I know some people who put their money in Icelandic krona. Mm-hmm. Well, Icelandic krona was paying 15%, but it collapsed, totally collapsed. So they were geniuses and lost everything. Right. So it's great to be a genius, but you got to be better than to be a genius because you might lose everything if you're too smart.
Yeah. You know, another thing that I remember you were telling Jack Schweiger is that a lot of times you'll make an investment, not necessarily on what you believe, but what you think the market believes. And I think that I know you've been in dollars for probably 4 or 5 years, just hearing your interviews. And you've always said that you dislike the dollar. It's incredibly flawed. But you know the market perceives it as a safe haven asset, and that's why you want to own it. So can you walk us through kind of your mindset, your mentality? How do you determine if you're right or you should bet with the market, because they're going to be, they're going to make the wrong decision based on the fundamentals, but you're going to kind of ride that momentum?
Well, you do have to understand, I have to understand that, yes, the market can be wrong, and market often is wrong, very often is wrong. The market's wrong about the U.S. dollar, if you ask me, but I own it because when they're wrong, they think it's a safe haven. They think it's the place to be. And I know that there are a lot more of them than there are of me. And if they all think that the U.S. dollar is a safe haven, I can sit down all day with them and show them why. What a horrible place to invest. But I own them too, because I know there are more of them than there are of me. And I know they still think that the US dollar is a safe haven. And as I look around at alternatives, there are not many alternatives. The euro is under serious stress and will be. The pound sterling is, oh my gosh, they got gigantic debts. I don't really see the Japanese yen, people will tell you, but Japan, the Japanese are just printing staggering amounts of money and borrowing staggering amounts of money. It's incomprehensible. Population has been declining for 12 years in Japan. I can go on and on. So why the yen for me is not the safe haven. There are not many places, George, is what I'm getting at. And the US dollar is about the only place left that makes any sense. And it doesn't make any sense, but there's nothing else. Yeah. Or virtually nothing else. I'm certainly looking. And if you find it, you send me an email.
I will.
Then you talk about it on Rebel Capital. Okay.
But I'll do it after I'll give you the news and the insights first, and then we'll talk
you
about it.
You buy all you can and you let me know and then tell the whole world. Okay.
So what's happening with China right now? It was, Evergrande was really in the news a couple months ago. And people were talking about how their real estate market is, call it 30%, 25% of GDP. And if Evergrande goes down, there could be some systemic risk with other real estate companies. And that could have kind of a cascading effect. I don't know, how that's really played out. It hasn't really been in the news lately. Have you been following that? And I know your long-term view on China, it probably doesn't change. But what are you seeing there in the short term or midterm?
Well, China has had a property bubble for a long time. It's just astonishing how high prices, especially in the coastal cities, went through the roof. And it's amazing how many times Beijing said, we've got to stop this.
Yeah.
Then they started this. It looks like they finally really, really done something and are doing something. Evergrande is part of the collapse, but other people are now getting collapsed too, because things were just totally out of control. And Beijing talked, but didn't act. But in my view now, the Chinese real estate bubble is finally being forced to, I don't want to use the word crack. Okay, it's going to go down. It is going down, which means that property developers are losing money. I don't own any of them. I don't own any bonds in those guys. But in my view, a long time property bubble in China is now being forced to do into correction. Let's use the word correction. And that means that they're obviously over leveraged people. There always are. You know, in America in the 20s, there was a gigantic property bubble in Florida that started popping 1927. The stock market collapsed in 29.
Right.
But it really started with the Florida real estate bubble popping. And it just got bigger and bigger and bigger, and then other things too. So that may be what's happening in China right now. China will have and should have bear markets. Everybody has them. America became the most successful country in the 20th century. We had some bear markets, serious bear markets along the way. That's the way the world works.
What was the relationship between Russia and China, you know, going back just a few months or a few years? And then how do you think it'll look moving forward based on what's happening right now with Ukraine? And again, it's just so hard to sift through this in the U.S. or being a part of the U.S. media and social media. There's so much noise. I'd love to hear it from you, because I know you're in a part of the world where you're probably getting a little bit more accurate information.
Well, again, George, you got to get sources from various places. You're right. So get information from the U.S., but then get it from Asia as well, from various places. No, I don't like saying it, I'm an American, but America's pushing China and Russia closer, closer together.
Yeah.
And if you get out a map or a globe, and you say, oh my gosh, I don't want to be in a war against China and Russia. You know, they're gigantic countries with huge assets, et cetera. But we're doing it. I mean, I sit and say to myself, how could they do that? How could they push Russia and China together? But they are. We, America, is. And George, that's not going to be fun if and when it comes to even more serious stuff. Because we are telling China and Russia, you're bad guys, you're horrible people. And so the Russians and the Chinese do a lot of trade together, and it's growing daily. And Iran, they're bringing in the Iranians. Iranians got to go somewhere. So yeah. They look at the map too, and they say, oh, well, what about Russia and China? Maybe we could be friends with them.
Yeah,
no, I do Saudi not Arabia see
it. It seems Saudi Arabia is taking the same stance as well. And, you know, with the United States or the Europe kicking Russia out of the SWIFT system, the messaging system, you know, China has their own. It's called CIPS. And it seems as though, you know, Russia will start using that. Obviously, they're motivated. And if you're China, looking at how the United States is playing this, or Europe is playing this with Europe, you know, if you're them, you're saying, okay, now we know the playbook and we know how to prepare for something like in the future. I'm not saying the United States should not have sanctioned Russia, but unfortunately in these situations, a lot of times there are no solutions. There are only trade-offs. And I think that may be one of the trade-offs.
Sanctions have rarely worked other than for a few days or a short time and maybe against a few people. It's sanctions are not successful. Politicians go on TV and say, you yeah. see, I put sanctions on them. Well, they should be a laughing stock. But go back, because you made a very, very, started a very important point. An international currency, an medium of exchange, is supposed to be neutral. When the US dollar is the world's reserve currency, people should be able to use, everybody should be able to use it for anything they want. Drugs, girlfriends, anything they want. Indiscriminately. But unfortunately, Washington has been changing the rules, because if they don't like you, even if they're wrong, they put sanctions on you, so you cannot use it. So many countries are already looking for a competitor to the US dollar. But George, this latest move accelerates it. Now, everybody, even people who are friends with the US, have to say to themselves, wait a minute. Suppose somebody doesn't like me, I wore the wrong shirt, who knows what. So there's a huge acceleration now in Asia and elsewhere to find something to compete with the US dollar. So you and I, who are Americans, have the problem that when the US dollar loses its status, as the world's reserve currency, it's not going to be good for any of us, including the US. It used to be the pound sterling. The pound sterling lost that status, and Britain was in serious decline and had many, many serious problems when it lost its status as the world's reserve currency. And I don't like saying it because they're shooting themselves in the foot. And unfortunately, they're shooting my foot too when they do it, because I'm an American citizen.
Yeah, you know, a couple interesting things there. I read that China is buying a significant position in Gazprom. So you and I can't buy Gazprom stocks, but China can, and they're taking advantage, I think, or maybe they're buying their debt. I read they're buying a big equity position. Who knows if that's accurate, because again, that's your Western media. But going back to, you know, what you're saying about other countries looking at this and saying, well, wait a minute, if they're going to do this to Russia, maybe we need to prepare for them to do, you know, weaponize the dollar, so to speak, and we need to get a way around that moving forward. I was reading a story the other day about, and I never knew this, but after the United States dropped the atomic bombs on Japan, World War II, a lot of our allies, I read, ramped up their nuclear programs, because even though they were our allies, when they saw us use the bomb against Japan, they said, well, wait a minute. We're in good standings right now with the United States, but if we get in their crosshairs in the future, then we've seen their playbook. We need to prepare for this. So as a result, all of these countries started to develop their nuclear programs. And it seems we could see the same thing, you know, countries developing their financial nuclear programs, if you will, just like we saw during World War II.
It's not, we could see, we are seeing, it is happening. Everybody now understands. Even if you're a friend, I mean, I live in Singapore. Singapore is a good friend of the US. But, I mean, they can look out the window and see what's happening. You don't have to be a genius to see that if for some reason, and that's why there is an accelerated move by many countries, you know, big countries, India, China, Russia, Brazil, you know, big players are trying to figure out a competing currency. They don't have it yet. Yes, there is the Chinese system, but it's not gigantic yet, but they're going to make it huge. And that is going to be very bad for you and me and for America. And we're doing it. We're forcing them to do it by this action against the Russians. Against anybody. And I don't know what's going to be the competitor for the dollar. I'm looking for it. I hope I find it. And if I do, I hope I'm smart enough to buy it. You know, gold is going through the roof. I don't think gold is going to, we're going to go back to the gold standard, but who knows? The Russians have bought a lot of gold in recent years. Chinese have bought a lot of gold in recent years. I bought some, nothing like what you have or other people have, but I got plenty of gold and silver. So I'm looking for, as is the world, the competitor to the US dollar.
Yeah, you know, I did.
I would say the Chinese renminbi, but it's a little absurd. I mean, the renminbi is a blocked currency. You can't even buy and sell it on the open market like you can the euro or something. Yeah. I own some renminbi, but unless they really open up the currency, it cannot be the renminbi, not yet anyway.
Yeah, it seems like they may be headed in that direction. You talked about Russia buying a lot of gold, and I used a couple charts in a whiteboard video I did the other day, and I noticed that they really started buying a lot. I mean, the trajectory of the curve just goes parabolic almost, starting in 2014 after they got sanctioned for going into Crimea. And what's fascinating is if you look at a chart of the gold that China owns, they started buying hand over fist at the exact same time Russia did. And now they both have over 2,000 tons, if my memory serves me right. And so I know it's not a lot compared to the United States. They have 8,000, but they've got a lot less, or at least Russia has a lot less government debt as well. And there's a lot fewer rubles out there to back with gold than there is dollars. That's for sure. So who knows what they're planning?
Well, I don't know what anybody's planning yet, but I do know they are planning. They are trying. They are, you said, they started buying gold. Somebody in Beijing and in Moscow had enough sense to say, guys, we better get prepared. And they're stocking, they have been stocking up on gold. And that will continue because what are they? They're not going to buy more US dollars. How could anybody, especially who's maybe like China, going to have more problems with the US, how could they buy more dollars? How could anybody? I own a lot of dollars, but I know that there's going to be a time when I'm going to have to sell my dollars, whether I like it or not, and put the money somewhere else.
Yeah. And what most people don't realize and what Russia is finding out right now is that those dollars they thought they owned are actually a liability of another bank that could be under the influence, let's say, of the United States, whether it's your dollars, my dollars, Russia's dollars, they're all a liability, an IOU from another bank.
When you say influence, it's not influence, the dictate of US.
Right.
The US will call you up and say, this is what you're going to do. And if you don't like it, you'll learn.
Yeah.
When we instigated that coup in Ukraine in 2014, I mean, and now we're blaming all the things on the Russians. I mean, I'm saying Putin's a good guy, but we started this. And now, of course, if you read American propaganda, oh my God, these poor Ukrainians and these horrible Russians. We started the whole thing. We instigated that coup. And anyway, you have to learn about propaganda. We all do.
Yeah, that's a key takeaway from this whole conversation. That's for sure. Jim, I'm going to let you go here. But before I do, I sincerely appreciate your time as always. And, you know, with what's going on with Russia, you're obviously the guy to talk to. But just as kind of a learning thought experiment, I mean, you've known some incredible investors in your life, and you've known the top guys and gals in the business. What would you say the top three attributes that make up a good investor that, you know, us amateurs looking on could learn from? Is it risk management? You know, that's what I see all the time. Or is there something more to it? What's your insight there?
Well, I don't know that I have the answer. I would become a great investor myself if I did. My main thing is the ability to stand against the crowd, or the ability to look at what's happening and say, wait a minute, that's not the right thing. That's not reality. You know, if everybody's saying the sky is blue, these guys go over and look out the window to see if the sky is blue. And then often they say, the sky is not blue. And then they act when everybody's shrieking and on the TV and on the internet, everybody's saying the sky is blue, the sky is blue. Some guy is smart enough to go look out the window. It's amazing to me how many people, if the government says the sky is blue, will not even look out the window, not even ask. I can tell you, as recently in Singapore, there was a guy, charlatan, a crook, who was telling the whole world that he had a huge business with Rio Tinto, the gigantic mining company, and that he was selling lead to them, huge amounts. And he raised hundreds of millions of US dollars because of he had this very lucrative business of buying and selling to Rio. Nobody even called up Rio Tinto to say, who is this guy? You know this guy? Are you doing hundreds of millions of? All they had to do was make one phone call, and they would have found that the whole gang was a fraud. I mean, he's in jail now, as he should be. But what is the shock to me? It's like I say, I mean, I'm not the first to know. Many people have learned that if the government says something enough times, everybody believes it. And back to the answer to your question is, it's the people who have enough sense or curiosity or whatever to go against the crowd or to understand that the crowd cannot be right and that we should do something else.
Yeah. Everyone likes I've noticed everyone likes to call themselves a contrarian investor until an opportunity comes up where it's very, very difficult to pull the trigger. And then all of a sudden they're saying, oh, well, I'm going to hold off on this one. You know, it reminds me of when COVID really hit the markets in March of 2020. And I mean, people thought the world was ending. And the contrarian play back then was to step in and buy. And, you know, that was the right thing to do, but very, very few people did. All the people that call themselves contrarian investors, they were still sitting on the sidelines. So it's one thing to say it, it's a whole different thing to do it.
Yeah, well, you ask what about successful investors? Those are the ones who do it, who figure it out and do it. And back to the beginning of this conversation, I would like to be investing in Russia right now. Cannot. And maybe I'm lucky that I cannot invest in Russia. But these opportunities come up periodically and everybody is terrified. And the government tells you, blah, blah, blah. Please do not get your investment advice from the government, any government. Certainly not the US government. You're going to go broke if you rely on governments for your investment advice.
Yeah.
Look out the window and make up your own minds.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And be patient. Yeah, that's one thing. We'll end on that. One of your quotes from Jack Schwager, he was asking you what your investment strategy was. And you said, you just wait till there's a big pile of money sitting in the corner and then you just go pick it up. And yeah, he kept pushing you. And he said, well, Jim, what if you have a view that the market's going to go up? You know, don't you try to play that view? And I think you told him specifically that that's the quick way to the poorhouse.
It is. But I mean, it's amazing to me that if you're a trader, you cannot do it. I mean, Roy Neuberger had some great traders in the world. Roy Neuberger's dead now, but you know, these guys couldn't wait 5 minutes before they bought and sold. That's not my style. Yeah. My style, I have learned, is to wait until literally, oh, look at all that money over there. Yeah. I just have to go over there and get it. Yeah. But you have to wait for those things to happen. And then, and George, as you know, then you, after you act, after you do something, you wait for it to play out. You don't go jumping in and out all day, every day. You wait. If you buy something that you know is going to work, you wait. And you, if you're right, it's going to go up for years. That's my style. Find something that'll go up for years. There'll be ups, there'll be downs, there'll be panics. You'll be scared at times. But if you can just do nothing for a long time, you know, I'm lazy. I like investing like this. I like just waiting till I find something and then I don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
I wait until some other change comes along.
Yeah. What's incredibly ironic is the amount of discipline required to pick up that money once you see it sitting in the corner. It's not that easy.
Oh, yes. But you've been waiting. And if you've been observing and doing your homework, doing your research, you will realize, that's it.
Yeah.
You know, everybody watching this knows a lot about something, whether it's cars or fashion or something. They should be successful investors because they just should wait until they see something that's changing dramatically in cars or fashion. Mm-hmm. Then they can do research and act.
Yeah.
But George, it's amazing how many people you can have this conversation with and they say, you're right. I'm going to do that now. But then they say, just give me one hot tip, though.
Yeah.
Just one hot tip. Everybody wants a hot tip. Everybody wants to be rich this week, including me.
Yeah, right.
You know, but hot tips will send you to the poorhouse.
That's right. That's right. Well, maybe we'll wait to give him that hot tip until our next interview. We'll keep him hanging there. We'll give him a cliffhanger.
Well, I look forward to the next time. I repeat that I'm envious that there you are in Medellin. It's such a great city, and I'm not current, but it must be great opportunities now. I know the property was such a staggering opportunity back then, and you say it still is going up. Well, it should be. It's just amazing. And some of those places where the restaurant district and the bar district.
That's where I am right now. Gosh. Yeah, that's right.
It was just dazzling. It was so alive and dynamic and vibrant. It was amazing. And, you know, many people in the world will tell you that the Colombian women and the Venezuelan women are the most beautiful. I don't know if they're the most beautiful, but there were certainly plenty of nice looking women the last time I was there.
That hasn't changed, Jim. That hasn't changed.
Good for you. And the Venezuelans for a while were the home of a beauty contest. They were winning beauty contests. I mean, Venezuela is a disaster right now.
Yeah.
Venezuela had some gorgeous women and they won beauty contests all over the world. And the Colombians said they did too. And yeah. they did.
The music, very, very salsa, the weather, the people, the food, it's the cost of living is just unbelievably low. And it's a 3-hour flight from Miami. There's a lot to like.
Can I tell you again, I'm envious of you. You change the name of your program to Rebel Columbia or something, Colombian Rebels or something. Yeah,
Insider, Medellin Insider. Well,
No. It's really a remarkable place. And after 50 years of civil war, somebody should have an opportunity. I'm delighted at you. Very impressed. Very, very impressed.
I'll let you know how it goes. And next time we'll talk about Turkey as well. It's another thing that's on our watch list. So we'll leave that as a cliffhanger for the audience. So Jim, I appreciate your time and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I wish I were there. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.